Which comedians do you get your science news from? As part of the comedy duo Newman and Badil, Rob Newman had everything a 1990s stand-up could want, in particular fame as the first stadium comedy act and the one for which the phrase "comedy is the new rock and roll" was coined. But these days his obsession is with stand-up's potential as an act of communication. And when you say it like that, it hardly sounds funny at all. But Newman has managed to make rollicking comedy from everything from environmental catastrophe to fuel politics, and in his latest show, Genetics. I went for a cup of coffee with the funniest environmentalist on the planet near his home in Holloway, North London.
As you say, it often is a kind of split for people when they think about what they can do through their own work and whether that should be channeled into kind of direct, specific actions. And I suppose in your own work, it isn't as though the concerns that you used to give vent to have disappeared in any way.
No, it's still there. It still informs everything I do. I mean, it gives you a way of looking at things. In the entirely accurate Encyclopedia of Evolution, which came out of the stand-up show New Theory of Evolution, I had a very definite sort of thesis that I wanted to put about evolution, which is to say, here's the works of Darwin, a very wonderful and little read philosopher and scientist whose views are totally opposed to the people who call themselves Darwinists in our time. And there's an interesting split here. And actually, I think a lot of damage is being done to us by the people who are shamelessly traducing Darwin's name. And that had a certain tone. With the Brain Show, it's a much lighter tone because I don't have one definite thing to say. I'm still staggered by the extraordinary pessimism about human nature of some of the leading neuroscientists. It's just breathtaking. But one can have great fun by opposing how most people feel about the world to these extraordinary curmudgeons who say things based on almost no evidence that, you know, the smile evolved as an aborted snarl, or different nationalities have different brains that see things in different ways. I make merry with neurobabble, and it's a much lighter tone, and somehow the jokes themselves, because brain imaging is such a visual thing, I end up doing quite a lot of visual jokes in the Brain Show, and there's about £15,000 worth of props, including a brain imaging hat and a flashing squid and a skull xylophone, and that gave sort of a levity to the tone.
So maybe if we look at Dawkins, the selfish gene, and you really, it's something you take apart in the book.
We didn't sort of invent it. It comes from Bill Hamilton's selfish herd theory. And I think it certainly doesn't come from Darwinism, this idea. I mean, Darwin says those communities which included the greatest number of the most sympathetic members would flourish best and produce the most offspring, and that's his definition of natural selection. Dawkins' idea derives not from Origin of Species, but Original Sin. It's very close to Martin Luther's definition. It's the infection from our mother's wombs, and this inborn sickness and hereditary sin condemneth to eternal wrath and damnation every creature born into the world. And you find it's based on philosophical assumptions rather than the science. It's the same in the Brain Show now with Ramachandran. He says that the smile evolved as a snarl. Well, that doesn't come from Darwin, because Darwin says that our habit of uttering reiterated sounds from a sense of pleasure evolves into the tendency to contract the orbicular and zygomatic muscles when any cause excites in us a feeling which, if stronger, would have led to laughter. So he says it's halfway to a laugh, not halfway from a smile. And so it doesn't come from Dawkins, but it's part of a sturdy philosophical tradition, and it has its root, if you go to Baudelaire, and that's ironic because they're saying, oh, look, I'm just a man of science. There's no misty, vague sentimentality about me. I see reality as it is. You may not like it. But actually it derives from Baudelaire, misty, vague sentimentalist, late romantic poet, who says that laughter is a man's way of baring his fangs. And there's a certain type of quite adolescent mind to whom this, you know, focusing on the dark stuff is somehow scientific and rigorous and deep, whereas a more cheerful idea, such as Darwin's, is somehow not scientific. It's a great slander on human beings, and it's sort of scientism rather than science. And Original Sin was never a very helpful myth, and if it comes back as a myth in a lab coat, it's still not helpful.
The science you portray in the book works a little bit like art did in a former way, in that it offers us kind of visions of structures of society, kind of fictions at the moment, but just alternative ways of thinking about the reality around us.
Every political system tries to justify the inequalities by saying it's just a law of nature. And so if you say, well, actually, there are very few laws of nature. I mean, that's one of the things that other sciences don't like about biology, is that it doesn't seem to have laws. It's not denying competition, but just saying that there are both things, both are totally intrinsic to life, and yet somehow it's seen as more hard-headed and rigorous to focus on things being, in Tennyson's phrase, red in tooth and claw. But that's not true of very much of the phylogenetic tree. It's Dictyostelium discoidium. They're forest floor foragers. They live in colonies of between 10 to 100,000. And they subsist on a diet of the rotting bark and decaying leaves that they find on the forest floor. These individual forest floor foragers, however, in time of crisis, they send out a chemical signal and they all congregate in a central location and they spend an afternoon turning themselves into a single multicellular slug with light-sensitive eye spots and a tail. And as this slug, they writhe, squirm and wriggle their way towards a patch of sunlight. And when they get there, the first 20% form out of their bodies a ridge stalk up which the other 80% climb. And when they get to the top, they form a giant fruiting berry. And just as the breeze disperses dandelion puffball spores, so a gust of wind bursts the fruiting berry and the dicty discos go floating through the air. And amazingly, this evolutionary strategy works. But the 20% who form the rigid stalk, they do not get to fly off to pastures new. They die that others may live. And that's quite common in nature. And it's an example of group selection, which one of the founders of the modern evolutionary synthesis, which in the 30s and 40s sort of rescued Darwinism by showing that rather than being disproved by Mendelian genetics, Mendelian genetics powerfully corroborated Darwin's theory of natural selection. Now, group selection is frowned on now because we all know individual laissez-faire capitalism is the only game in town. We all know that private good, public bad. So it doesn't matter what Ernst Mayr says, it doesn't matter what Darwin says, it doesn't matter what the Dictyostelium discoidium are doing. And so it's a common thing in nature that we survive as a group. People say, well, the lion has evolved to this, or the zebra has evolved to this, but it's penguins, plural, that have evolved to withstand six-week-long Antarctic blizzards by huddling together. The penguin hasn't evolved to do anything except menace the good people of Gotham City. And after the Second World War, this idea of survival of the fittest was an odium because dead heroes leave no offspring and all the best and the brightest had died. But then, you know, a decade or so later, we can sort of say clearly, you know, cream rises to the top and all that stuff.
Rob Newman there, and wouldn't his book on the new world of evolutionary science make a great present for the budding epigeneticists in your life? It's called The Entirely Accurate Encyclopedia of Evolution. And you can hear a longer version of that interview on Saturday week, January 2nd, in a special edition of the Culture File Weekly. Tomorrow's Culture File Weekly is at 6:30 p.m. And next week, we're exploring a world of Christmas food memory on the Daily Culture File, starting Monday at 5:40 p.m.